A reading from the book of Exodus. Yahweh said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and wait there, and I will give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction." So Moses set out with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up onto the mountain of Yahweh. To the elders he had said, "Wait here for us until we come to you again, for Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute may go to them." Then Moses went up on the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of Yahweh settled on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of Yahweh was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. Moses entered the cloud and went up on the mountain. Moses was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. Moses came down from Mount Sinai. As he came down from the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant in his hand, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with Yahweh. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, the skin of his face was shining, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses spoke with them. Afterward, all the Israelites came near, and he gave them in commandment all that that Yahweh had spoken with him on Mount Sinai. When Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil on his face. But whenever Moses went in before Yahweh to speak with him, he would take the veil off until he came out. And when he came out and told the Israelites what he had been commanded, the Israelites would see the face of Moses, that the skin of his face was shining, and Moses would put the veil on his face again until he went in to speak with him. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Matthew. Jesus told his disciples, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? For what will they give in return for their life? For the Son of Man is to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay everyone for what has been done. Truly I tell you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly they appeared to them, Moses and Elijah, talking with him. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make three dwellings here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud a voice said, "This is my Son, the Beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. The Gospel of Christ.
The account of the Transfiguration is one of those episodes in the life of Jesus that often makes you wonder. It's so supernatural in its execution, in its description, in what is said to have happened, that one can sit there and go, you know, did that really happen, you know? And given that we've been thinking about how in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew has been deliberately shaping the story of Jesus to line up with Moses in ancient Israel, someone might think that maybe that's what's going on here. Because if you were listening closely to the first reading that Susan read, Exodus 24 and 34, and compare it with the gospel reading that Margaret read, you'll find a lot of parallels. Back in Exodus, Moses went up on a mountain. In the gospel, Jesus took Peter, James, and John and went up on a mountain. On the mountain, there ended up being this cloud overshadowing Moses. So it happened on the Mount of Transfiguration. We have this episode where Moses coming down from the mountain has his fight, the skin of his face shining brightly. Jesus on top of the mountain is transformed and he shines brightly and his clothes are super, super duper white. We end up hearing the idea that Moses is hearing from God and God is even writing into stone what it is that he wants the people to hear. And so the voice of God is heard by Moses on Mount Sinai and there is the voice from heaven on the Mount of Transfiguration. And then the people were frightened at what was going on the mountain when Moses was up there. And the disciples are terribly afraid on the Mount of Transfiguration and have to be told by Jesus not to be fearful. And then, of course, in both cases, they come down from the mountain. So it might look that like Matthew is simply putting this episode of Jesus in his gospel to make these connections like he's been doing earlier. But the transfiguration appears in all three synoptic gospels. It's in Matthew and Mark and Luke. Mark was the first one that was written, and so they've, you know, Matthew and Luke both have taken Mark's initial account, and they've tweaked it a little bit, but the tweaks are actually quite minor. If anything, Luke adds a little bit more to the story, but otherwise it's pretty consistently the same. So it doesn't work for us now to say that Matthew was simply crafting something to continue with his theme. This is something that all three gospel writers hold to. And that makes us think that there's something rather significant about this event. Now, when we ask about its significance, we can see what it is that took place and think, well, all right, Jesus had said just before, I tell you the truth, some of you standing here will not taste death until you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And then, 6 days later, Peter, James, and John go with Jesus up the mountain and this whole transfiguration experience happens. So that's significant. And the significance is added to the fact that both Moses and Elijah joined Jesus on top of the mountain. Now, someone might wonder, well, how would they know it was Moses and Elijah? Because, you know, you don't have photography back then. There wasn't any pictures of Moses and Elijah that you could refer to. It's like, hey, I've seen that guy somewhere. You know, you can't do that. But they are told that they're talking with Jesus. And in the Gospel of Luke, Luke says that they were actually talking with Jesus about his departure. So whatever it is, the point is they're talking. So we could presume that Peter, James, and John heard Jesus saying, well, Moses, what do you think? And well, Elijah, what do you think? And then they'd put two and two together and realize that Moses and Elijah are there with Jesus. Of course, the significance about that is at another level yet again, because Moses represents the law, the Torah. And Elijah is considered the greatest of the prophets. He represents the prophets. And when you hear references to the law and the prophets, that's referring to the entire Hebrew Bible. That's one of the ways that the Old Testament is called. So here Jesus is connected with the law and the prophets, with Moses and Elijah, which is also adding something hugely meaningful to this whole episode. And so one might say that the significance of the transfiguration is that here Peter, James, and John got to see clearly this connection of Jesus, the one that they've come to understand as the Messiah, as being connected significantly to the Hebrew Bible, to Moses and Elijah. And in his transfiguration, you see something of his divinity, that Jesus is indeed divine. And this is the thing that needs to be paid attention to. And the voice from heaven even says, "This is my Son whom I love. With him I am well pleased." And we could go, there it is. That's why the transfiguration is so important. This zoomy experience of seeing the glory of God clearly through Jesus. But then we have to ask, why then did only Peter, James, and John get to see that? And in fact, when they come down from the mountain, Jesus will tell them, now don't say anything about what you've seen here until after I have been raised from the dead. Okay, if this is so important, why would Peter, James, and John not be allowed to talk about it until later? Why is it that only the three would come? Now, we know that Peter was the first among equals among the 12 apostles, and Peter, James, and John were kind of like the tight group that Jesus had among his 12 apostles, and then he had additional disciples on top of that. So in some ways, it's not exactly unique that Peter, James, and John might be taken aside, but if this is such a significant thing to think that Peter, James, and John got to experience this amazing vision of Jesus, why would it only be them? Wouldn't it make sense for others to see that too? If the whole idea was to get the picture of the divinity and the power and the majesty of Christ, wouldn't it make sense for more people to see that than just those three? And in fact, the reality is the only reason that we know this happened at all is because Peter, James, and John did say something about it. Otherwise, it would have been lost to the mists of time. But could it be that the significance of the transfiguration is not the amazing, zoomy visual experience that Peter, James, and John had, but what the outflow of that was meant to be? Because you see, the voice from heaven said a little bit more than what I had just quoted. "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him," was the last thing the voice says. And when we hear that word, "listen to him," well, now we start to see what the real emphasis of this episode is all about. The idea is that Peter, James, and John certainly have this visionary experience which amazes them and just nails things down for them, but the practical point of the transfiguration is to listen to what Jesus has been saying. And you don't have to have a mountaintop experience in order to be able to do that. You don't have to be one to have experienced this to understand that you can listen to the words of Jesus, to pay close attention to them, ultimately to do what it is that he says. For Peter, James, and John, perhaps they were given this experience so that as the leadership among the apostles and the rest of the disciples, they were able to be fully convinced in their own minds and then continue to pass on the importance of listening to Jesus. And in fact, in the last chapter of the book of Matthew, Jesus will say to his disciples, "Go into all the world and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you." Which would mean that the disciples had been listening to Jesus in the first place in order to pass that on to someone else. So the real point, I would suggest, about the transfiguration is less about the revelation of God's glory in Christ and more about the unquestioning last statement of the voice that Jesus is someone to listen to. Now, that's nowhere near as exciting as looking for a glory experience like that. It's way more fun to think, oh, what would it have been like to have been Peter, James, and John and been on the Mount of Transfiguration and seen Jesus like that? Yeah, that would have been pretty cool, but there was only those three guys that got that experience. None of the other apostles did. None of the first century disciples did. And why would we think that we ought to be so special that maybe that might happen to us one day? That's not The point is to come away from the account of that mountaintop experience with those three words ringing in our ears: listen to him. Now, what had Jesus been saying that we should listen to him? Well, of course, he's been teaching all sorts of things on several occasions. There's no question there. But in the earlier part of that gospel reading, Jesus told his disciples, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, but those who lose their life for my sake will find it." That isn't quite as exciting as being able to have the mountaintop transfiguration experience. But that's what Jesus had said just 6 days before. And now they're being reminded, you got to pay attention to that. You know, we'd kind of rather not do that, you know, because Jesus says things that are really challenging. Jesus gives us instructions that are hard to do. You know, we have the standard love God, love your neighbor. Okay, everybody heard that, you know. I mean, we hear that all the time. And in the 8 o'clock service, you hear that recited every Sunday morning, you know. Like, that's just normal. Well, everybody knows that. Like, come on, give me something a little bit more interesting. But no, that's what Jesus said we're supposed to do. He said we're supposed to love our enemies. He said we're supposed to forgive our brother or sister if they sin against us over and over and over again. He said that if someone wants to force us to go 1 mile with them, we should be ready to go a second mile for them. We're supposed to give to anyone who asks. We're supposed to be one who looks out for the needs of others. And to recognize that when we do things for the least of these, we're doing them to Jesus. But those things aren't as exciting, and they're actually kind of challenging. They're rather mundane, and they are often really hard to do. And truth be told, I think the history of the Christian church would show that we would much rather try to do our best to somehow recreate something of the atmosphere of the Mount of Transfiguration, whether we've got gold leaf everywhere in our sanctuaries or we're trying to have a charismatic worship service and we've got music going and we just want the glory of God to fall, because it's way more fun to worship Jesus than it is to do what Jesus said. But it's interesting, Jesus actually never told us to worship him. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to worship Jesus. Don't misunderstand me. But it's interesting that he never required his disciples to worship him. Instead, he gave them instruction on how to live that the kingdom of heaven might be seen in us. And so the Mount of Transfiguration, significant though it was for Peter, James, and John, was all about those last three words for them to pass on to everybody the importance of knowing that what we need to be about is listening to Jesus. So how do we do that? Well, sometimes we think it'd be great if we actually could literally listen to Jesus. And some people will say that they'd had an experience or they even heard a voice audibly and they took that to be Jesus or God or something. But that's relatively few of us. If we're trying to once again make listening to Jesus something zoomy, we're already on the wrong track. Because now we're trying to recreate something of this. Oh yeah, I heard Jesus today. Well, sometimes that's what we mean if we feel an urge within us and we think that the Spirit of God is at work, the Spirit of Jesus is saying something. But it's still far simpler than that. Listening to Jesus means, for us, reading what it is that he said and taking it seriously. Looking at the words that have been recorded of the things that he said, and then just simply saying, okay, if I was standing there and Jesus said that right in front of me, how would I take it? How would I put it into practice? Because it is in putting into practice the things that Jesus taught that we see the thing Jesus promised coming. The kingdom of heaven will be revealed when people are acting in the way that he said we are to act, when we are doing what he said we would do, when we are exhibiting those very qualities that he celebrated about the kingdom of heaven. And there's no shortcut. That's how it goes. But it's relatively boring. It's relatively mundane. It's nowhere near as exciting as the zoomy stuff. If you go into a Christian bookstore, any Christian bookstore these days, you will find a section devoted to spiritual warfare. Because we would rather try to figure out what Paul meant when he said that there are powers and principalities and rulers of this dark age. We would rather deal with the we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but with those same powers and try to figure out, okay, how does that go? You know, how can I be more spiritually in tune? And a lot of people are really hung up on, you know, how to deal with demons or angels and all of that. When Jesus talked very little about spiritual warfare and way more about spiritual agriculture. Because he would talk about planting seeds. And being careful not to uproot wheat when you're thinking you should wheat uproot the weeds. He would talk more about seeing things grow and cultivate and develop. You see very little about Jesus teaching about going in and conquering something. In fact, he was quite the opposite. Jesus' approach is something subversive, something that works under the scenes, something that has an influence from within that begins to change the larger picture. Nowhere near as exciting. But that's the way Jesus said it works. And so how, then, can we take this and put it into practice, this listening to Jesus thing? Well, by way of example, let's just go ahead and take one of the things that Jesus commanded that we should do, the one where he said, love your enemies and do good to those that harm you. What is it going to look like to actually do that? Now, of course, we can imagine, you know, being nice to people, even if they're mistreating us and stuff, but let me give you this image. If you have two people that are in conflict with each other, it's like they're button heads. You've got these clenched fists. They're always in conflict. One is trying to beat back the other or trying to overpower the other. And especially when it comes to relationships, this is tremendously difficult to deal with. There is no harmony here. There is no peace. It's hard to imagine love in this scenario. We could say that the way this ought to be reflected is coming to each other with an open and generous hand, perhaps even interlinking fingers in unity, seeing two people functioning in this way, serving each other, rather than trying to fight each other. Here are enemies, here are friends. Here are opponents, here are colleagues. Here are siblings with rivalry, here are brothers and sisters who love each other. But if you find yourself in this situation, how do you get to this spot? Well, unless both people simultaneously realize this ain't working, and we have to come towards each other with openness and grace and harmony and generosity, nothing's going to change. Unless, in this situation, one person realizes, I can't keep doing this. Jesus would say that I need to be one who approaches this differently. And more often than not, the resolution to this situation is because one person begins to love their enemy. One person puts themselves in a situation to serve, to have that open hand, to be generous, to be mindful of the other, to consider them and to be kind, with the hope that this person would see what's going on here and realize, you know, maybe this is a better way. But this is why this is all about taking up your cross daily. Because in doing this, it's now really easy for the other person to take advantage of that. And there's always risk involved in being one who would operate generously and graciously with unconditional love. Loving your neighbor, loving your enemy, can come with a cost. And yet Jesus says, this is what I want you to do. And if we're going to listen to Jesus, we have to be prepared to be the one who starts the process of peacemaking and reconciliation, the only way that it can be done, by putting ourselves in a vulnerable position. Now, let me say that I understand that there are all sorts of complications in this kind of scenario. I am not talking about just putting yourself repeatedly in an abusive situation. I am not talking about not having healthy boundaries. I am not talking about just allowing yourself to be a doormat for everybody to walk over. That is not what I am saying. But I am saying, because I think Jesus is saying that, that in order to love your enemy, the only way it can be done is to be the one to take this first step. And there is risk involved. And there is a potential cost. But the hope is that this is what will change things. And if we're going to see the kingdom of heaven on earth, a place marked by peace and harmony and mutual submission and fellowship and love and all of these things, how else can it come? I mean, apart from just waiting for Jesus to come back and fix everything. But that's not how Jesus ever talked. He said, this is our task. And one of the reasons why listening to Jesus involves picking up our cross daily and dying to ourselves is so often when we are following Jesus in this way, we don't see the results we would expect that we would see. And so often, choosing to do things like this and the other things he talks about, it just doesn't look like it works. And so then it's easy for us to say, okay, it's nice for Jesus to talk about that. But in this real world, how can I? And yet, Oftentimes you hear about people who at some point in their lives kind of had this turning around, awakening, born again experience, even if you will. And they realize that life should be different. And they can look back and they can see, I get it now. That when my friend or the guy that I saw as my enemy changed his attitude toward me, now I get it that he was trying to show love to me. Now I understand that this person was trying to be gracious to me. Now I get what was going on. And now the penny has dropped and I need to realize that I have to start living more like that. At this moment, it didn't work. Buddy just went ahead and clamped down on that person. But now he can look back and realize, I get it now. And the thing of it is if everybody learns to respond like this, then of course things are better. But how is it going to start? Only when someone listens to Jesus and begins to live in accordance with his will and purpose. It's not zoomy. It's not exciting. It's hard, it's mundane, and there's risk involved. But nevertheless, that is what Jesus calls us to. So if we were with Peter, James, and John on the Mount of Transfiguration, would we be taken up with the glorious vision? Or would we hear those last three words and take those things to heart? Listen to him. Amen.